I felt like, can you put that into the leadership realm where on day one, if you're on camera saying that you are a leader, is that going to impact how you carry yourself? Is that going to impact the types of decisions that you make in the cafeteria or on campus when you see something that you know is wrong? But I wanted that soundtrack in the back of their head of, I am a leader. So kind of an interesting thing we do.
Welcome to the Your Living Brand Live Show. This show is all about how you communicate your value, how you build influence through trust, and recognizing who your audience is and who they are not. Through our weekly conversations with our guests, we will explore different ways to enable you to demonstrate your uniqueness while we ask them, what's your story? And now, welcome our host, Ben Baker.
Welcome to another episode of the Your Living Brand Live Show. Welcome back, my wonderful audience. Thank you for coming back week after week, listening in, sharing, talking to me on social media. I'm all over LinkedIn. You can always find me there. Tell me what you like. Tell me what you don't like. Tell me who you want me to interview, because I'm always listening. I love talking to my audience. This week, I'm talking to another veteran. I love supporting the veteran community. I mean, it is one of my honors. It is one of my privileges to be able to bring these amazing people who have done so much for our country and enable us to do what we do. So I want to bring on board Brian Price. Brian was introduced to me by Michael Norton from Zinnix. He was on the show at the end of 2021, and he and I have talked off air, and we are going to have an amazing conversation about developing the next generation of leadership and performance under pressure. So Brian, welcome to the show.
Ben, really happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
We had an amazing conversation. I always have a pre-interview. I always bring people on for 30 minutes, a couple weeks before we go on air, just to get to know them, to find out a little bit about them, to be able to talk about what are we going to talk about, and be able to make sure that the interview goes as well as we can. And you and I had an incredible conversation because you spent 20 years in the military.
I did. Served from 1998 to 2018 and retired from the Army as a lieutenant colonel.
So I'm going to let you tell your story because, you know, for me to tell your story, I won't give it service. So tell me a little bit about your career up to this point and where you are today.
Yeah, absolutely. And just thinking back to that pre-call conversation, maybe we should have recorded that. That was
was really good. We should have just put that on tape.
There's some nuggets there. Yeah, so I'm a Jersey Shore kid. So for those of you that have ever seen the MTV shows, that is not what the real Jersey Shore is like. But yeah, grew up out here on New Jersey. Three-sport athlete in high school, went to West Point for my undergraduate, played baseball there. I was able to co-captain the team as a senior. And then if you're familiar with the academies, once you graduate, you have to go for a period of service to the country. And I thought I was going to serve for my initial 5 years and then kind of get out and do something else. But the joke was on me. I ended up serving for 20 years, as you just mentioned. The first half of my career, I was commissioned actually as an aviation officer. So I flew the Army's premier attack helicopter, the Apache Longbow, had some operational experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then you talked about giving back to veterans. When I look at my service in the Army, I look at the Army gave me way more than I was able to ever give it. And so one of the great things that the Army does, they send some of their individuals back to grad school at some of the greatest universities in the country. So the Army sent me for 3 years to go to Stanford University out on your coast to get a PhD in political science. And I spent the second half of my career teaching at West Point as a professor. I taught in the Department of Social Sciences and talked international relations and then national security. And then I ran a place there called the Combating Terrorism Center for 6 years up until 2018, which was a really unique outfit where we were able to do original research and brief the nation's senior leaders on counterterrorism issues. So we can talk about performing under pressure in those situations. And then I had always told my wife that at the 20-year mark, she would have veto power over whether I could stay in the military or not. I thought she forgot. She did not.
She was sitting there right at the 20-year mark with her veto in hand.
She was watching the countdown clock there. And I loved every bit of it. And I would have stayed in. She's been always been kind of my rock. And I have a 13-year-old daughter, too. So I was happy to call it quits and started up a leadership institute at Seton Hall University called the Vecino Leadership Institute. And then on the side, I started my own business called Top Mental Game, where I work with elite athletes and senior business leaders on mental performance and leadership and kind of performing at your best when it matters the most. So hopefully that's a kind of a truncated version of my story.
It's incredible, because to be able to think that the military thinks enough of you to send you back to Stanford to get your PhD is incredible on its own. They obviously saw something in you, that you were not just this helicopter pilot. They saw that you had that leadership capabilities and that you were able to lead others. And it's amazing the trajectory that one change probably made in your life. So why don't you take me through that? Because that is a real transition from being an active duty officer in the field in Afghanistan and other places that you probably were, to going back, getting the academic degree, and then becoming both a teacher within the military and also an advisor to, as you said, security and national security.
Yeah, I think big picture wise, it's kind of indicative of many elite organizations that they may talk about people are our greatest asset, but the military and the Army specifically, I think, really kind of preaches that. And so they are willing to devote the resources and the time and the money in order to kind of pull an active duty line officer. You know, I was a company commander prior to going to Stanford for 33 months with the same unit.
Wow. And that's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, normally you get a year, 18 months even. But in this situation, it was such a weird situation where the unit that I was in had just come back from Iraq and was transitioning from the Alpha model to the Delta model in the Apache. And that was done at Fort Hood in Texas. But the unit was originally from Germany. So after an 8-month train up in the States, we then moved all the families and all the helicopters over to Germany. And then we got orders to go to Afghanistan. And so it was like this weird over 3 continents, you know, like 33 months with that organization. So I went from that environment of leading 106 folks in combat in Afghanistan to being plopped in Palo Alto on Stanford's campus. And it was a culture shock, if you will. I tell a story about on my first day of class, the kid sitting next to me, you know, we're making small talk. He asked me where I'm from. And I said, you know, I'm military, just came back from Afghanistan and now I'm here, Army's dime. And he said, oh, that's awesome. I said, what's your story? He said, well, I graduated UCLA at the age of 16. And then he said, I went to Harvard Law School and graduated there by the time I was 20. And then I've been practicing law for a couple of years and then I came back. So like you talk about imposter syndrome, which is a topic maybe we can get into later. I was feeling all of it. But, you know, in the Army and I think throughout my time in the military and sports, like my mindset, I think, was work as hard as you can, outwork everybody, and good things will happen.
That's an interesting transition, talking about imposter syndrome and talking about developing the generation of leaders, because there has been that wonderful phrase, fake it till you make it, which in some cases drives me absolutely crazy. And I'd love for you to talk about that, because when you're developing the next generation of leaders, they're all full of aspiration, self-confidence, all the things that they do, but they don't really have the experience or the true skills to be the leader that they can be. And how do we take them out of that imposter syndrome and get them comfortable in their own pockets so they can be that next generation of great leaders?
This is a really interesting topic. I have some data on this because over the past 4 years, we have administered an assessment called the EQI 2.0 Emotional Intelligence Assessment, which is also used by corporations as well. And it kind of rates you on these 16 different competencies related to emotional intelligence. And in some of those assessments, some of those categories are things like self-regard, self-actualization. And what we found with all of the students that have taken it, and by this point, we have about 270 students over the course of 4 years that have taken it. So it's interesting to see the data. And when you talk about fake it till you make it, the students that we're able to work with are competitively selected. So they are the cream of the crop, the brightest students coming to Seton Hall University. But when you peel back the onion and you see a look at their EQI assessments, what you'll notice is their self-actualization is usually very high, meaning like going back to that ambition and wanting to do some fantastic things in your life. But the self-regard is not there. So it's almost like some of these students have been putting on masks a little bit over time. And yet when you peel the onion back, their self-regard isn't there. And we talk about the imposter syndrome at length, and it affects 70% of the population that they think. So even if you're not suffering from it, I guarantee the people that are leading underneath you, or family and friends of people you care about, are suffering. I'll give you one kind of thing that we do right off the bat. One is, in our unique program, every one of our students has the opportunity in the 4-year program to have a leadership coach assigned to them. So an executive leadership coach that are usually, because we're so close to New York City, those coaches usually coach the CEOs and those folks, but they believe in our mission that they come and coach in our program. But another thing that we did this year, which is, I think, interesting, on the very first day of class, we put them through kind of a conveyor belt where one of the stations that they were in was, they were in front of a video camera. And I had them say their first name, I had them say their hometown, and then I had them say, and I am a leader. And we videotaped that, and it was amazing to see some of the students were definitely faking it when they were saying it.
They were definitely dialing it in.
Yeah. And some of my faculty were like, why did we do that? And to be honest, this is kind of a weird segue, but when I was in counterterrorism in the Army, I saw that suicide bombers oftentimes would have like a celebration the night before where their handlers would actually film them saying their goodbyes, if you will. And it was like a costly signal that they were trying to do so that they would follow through on their commitment the next day. And I felt like, can you put that into the leadership realm where on day one, if you're on camera saying that you are a leader, is that going to impact how you carry yourself? Is that going to impact the types of decisions that you make in the cafeteria or on campus when you see something that you know is wrong? But I wanted that soundtrack in the back of their head of, I am a leader. So kind of an interesting thing we do.
And I love that because one of the phrases that I tend to use is, leadership is an attitude, not a job title.
Love it.
And we get to the world where everybody has the ability to lead. Not everybody has the skills to lead, but everybody has the ability to lead. And what we need to do is we need to grow that next generation of leaders. I'm not convinced that anybody is born the leader that they can be. Everybody is going to lead to their ability. Some people are going to lead a group of five people. Some people are just going to lead themselves. Some people are going to lead a nation. But every single one of them needs to be taught how to lead. And I think that some of that is the performance under pressure. It's how do you act and how do you react when you get squeezed? And I think that that's an interesting thought process.
First of all, I could not agree more with everything you just said. We tell our students leadership is a mindset. It's not a job title. Very similar in terms of what you just put forth. The other thing that I think is when you talk about performing under pressure, when you have the mindset that you are a leader, you're just going to approach things, I think, very differently than if you're a follower. And in our four-year program, you hit on a couple points. One of our first year is about leading yourself, because I argue that you can't lead others unless you can lead yourself. And then in year two, it's leading others. And then in years three and four, we get closer to leading in your discipline and some of those things. You always hear people, the age-old debate of, are leaders born or made? And I'm a big proponent like you that even if you do have those natural leadership skills and talents, leaders are learners. And when you stop learning, you stop leading. We tell our students and the business leaders is like, you never make it as a leader. And if you feel like you've made it, it's time to kind of exit stage left.
Means that you're probably not in a big enough room.
100%. I'm a big proponent of relentless improvement. And I'll give you a very reasonable excuse for kind of learning. When you strip everything down, leadership, in my opinion, is about people. And people change. We change over the course of our life. Society's norms and morals and ethics and those sorts of things change over time. So if you are going to be a leader and you're going to assume you're going to want to lead multiple generations of people, well, then by definition, you have to change, right? I think there are still some bedrock principles that we can all abide by in terms of like things that we believe in the institutes, things like servant leadership. Nobody wants the toxic, tyrant, authoritarian leadership style. But if you look at that perspective of people are going to change, therefore, I should keep updating the ways that I can connect the best and most effective with the people that I'm leading.
That's interesting because we all need to improve. As you said, it's the reading, it's the questioning, it's the saying, how can I be better? I tell people, it says, great leader wakes up every single morning and says, how can I make my team better? It's not how can I make myself better. That's a given. It's how can I make my team better? How can I help them improve? I had an interesting guy and he talked, and I want to get back to performance under pressure, but this is just a thought and I wanted your thought on this. He leads a fairly large organization. And when he's hiring the next generation of leaders, the first thing he does is he looks at their LinkedIn profile and he reads through it. And he says, if they're not leading online, if they're not presenting online thought leadership, creativity, helping other people out, you know, instilling confidence in others and stuff like that, they're never going to do that in person. And I'd love to know, do you guys get into that you are one whole person whether you're online, whether you're offline, whether you're in front of somebody, whether you're talking on the phone, whatever? Is that something that you guys get into?
100%. This is like particularly important, I think, for this upcoming generation, you know, the kind of the Gen Z folks that are coming up, that are growing up in a digital world like you and I did not grow up in. My kind of phrase for this is leaders don't have office hours. You can't just punch the clock and be a leader from 9 to 5 and then at home and away from either campus or work, and particularly online, you can't be a different person. So 100%. And one of the things that I talk about, particularly like with a platform like LinkedIn, you touched on a great point, which is the algorithm is built, I think, you can tell me if I'm wrong here, that the more you engage on there, the more those types of people will be seeing your content. And so if you are pumping other people up and commenting on other people, even if you don't post a lot, I think you're going to see some interesting networking positive effects on that over time. And so for us, again, I couldn't agree more in terms of the leaders don't have office hours. It's the whole person.
It's all about building relationships, whether it's in person, online, whatever, because you never know when you can either be valuable to somebody else or they can be valuable to you. And if you've built that know, like, and trust, you can ask for those favors. But if you haven't, you know, nobody's going to follow you, whether you call yourself a leader or not.
Gary Vaynerchuk is kind of famous for this component of the jab, 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 right hook. Meaning, can you provide value on your social media feeds and give people value and pump them up? And then occasionally you can make your ask. But it doesn't work very well when you're just making asks and you don't give back to the community.
Hi, everyone. Do you want to be your best customer's vendor of choice? Do you want to cement relationships with them, add real value, and gain insights that your competitors just can't get? Go to podcasthostforhire.com. That's podcasthostforhire.com. And let's work together to make you the value vendor of choice. So let's change gears and talk about the squeeze, because I'm a big believer that any single person shows their true colors when they're squeezed. Some people rise, some people fall. And I want to know, how do you help this next generation deal with pressure when a lot of them, quite honestly, the pressure that they feel to is first world problems. They've never been in combat. They've never had somebody shoot at them. They've never been in a situation where it's live or die. It's first world pressure. And how do you get them to understand how to rise above when with all they see is this, oh my God, I can't move any further. But in the grand scheme of things, there's always an option.
Especially in this world of kind of helicopter parents and how some of these students that I get a chance to work with have been brought up. I think from a big picture standpoint, it's kind of important to understand how your body reacts under pressure. And so this is the cool part where the blending of the mental performance and the leadership kind of really, really come together. I'll talk a little bit in sports terms, but it's definitely applicable on the other side. So one of the things that I talk to my students about is we're all familiar with kind of fight, flight, or freeze responses that we have. And I think that's what you were referring to earlier. So there's a theorem called the Yerkes-Dodson theorem. Simpletons like myself call it the inverted U curve. So just think of like an upside down U. And what that theory says is that with increasing amounts of stress or pressure, maybe counterintuitively, our performance should increase, but only up to a certain point. And that point is different for everybody. At which time, if you continue to increase that stress or pressure, your performance is going to decline. You're going to be overstimulated. You're not going to be able to function. So the sports example here is take basketball. So you're probably not going to perform at your best at your like world record performance in the backyard with your sibling. That pressure gets increased a little bit if you talk about a preseason game. Then I think everybody has some type of green zone, or I call it in the zone, in the flow, whatever you want to refer to it as. But beyond that, let's say now you're playing in front of a huge crowd against a rival in a critical moment. Now you're starting to feel that pressure and you might be in your own head. And then at the extreme, it might be no time on the clock. You're shooting a free throw to win the game with shooting a 1-1. Like that's extreme pressure. So if you understand how that kind of dynamic, I think it's important for people to have, number one, self-awareness of where you are on that chart. For some of us, we might need a little more stress and pressure in order for us to perform at our peak. I would say the most challenges that I have with both business leaders and athletes is when they're overstimulated, though. And so if you are overstimulated and you're feeling like the world's on top of you and you're either fight or flight mode, you have to have some tools in your toolkit in order to kind of cope with those things. These aren't like magical tools. Like these are things like something as simple as incorporating mindful breathing when you're in that moment. Self-talk is a huge one. You know, I tell my athletes and business leaders, right now, if you don't know whether your self-talk, generally speaking, is either hurting you or helping you, I guarantee you it's hurting you. You know, it's in our DNA to be kind of negative and on the lookout for threats. It is not in our DNA to be like confident and motivated. We kind of have to get to that spot. And then the third one, skills and drills that I do with my athletes and business leaders, has to do with kind of like visualization and imagery exercises. Something as simple, say if you have performance anxiety, giving a presentation in front of a board of directors, if you will, what types of things can you do in the lead up to that to make you feel more comfortable? And my thing is, what I tell my athletes and my business leaders is, our brains oftentimes have a difficult job differentiating fantasy from reality. How do we know that? If you've ever woken up from a nightmare in the comfy confines of your own bed, and you're sweating and you're breathing heavy and your body's reacting, you're in the most safest place in your house. But with visualization imagery, you can kind of put yourself in those moments and see yourself succeeding, see yourself getting through whatever obstacles are kind of in front of you. And that can be built into your subconscious so that you're going to be more confident. I'll give you one quick anecdote on that. Missy Franklin is one of the greatest swimmers in American history. Had her glory moments in the 2012 Olympics, won 5 medals, 4 gold in that event. And she was on a great podcast called Finding Mastery, where she was discussing her use of visualization and imagery to prepare her for that competition. And so she would actually, like a lot of athletes, would use visualization and imagery exercises to almost like put her in that scenario of swimming and how many strokes was she taking and what did it feel like? What did the arena sound like? Kind of incorporating all of your senses. And so there she was going out for the first time ever for a gold medal heat in the 200 meter backstroke. And she sees all of her competitors and they look all nervous and tense. And she says, because of that pre-work, she felt like it was her 50th time doing this. And then she goes out and breaks the world record in that event and wins a gold medal. But I think all those similar tools can be incorporated to business leaders that are either stuck in imposter syndrome or fearful for their consequences of giving a presentation in front of others. The body reacts the same way, whether you are getting ready for a gold medal heat, whether you're getting ready to stand up in front of a crowd. How do you deal with imposter syndrome or these confidence issues when you're doing all the keynotes that you do?
Yeah, I mean, for me, if I'm not nervous before a keynote, I'm crazy. There's always that level of tension and that anticipation before, and I thrive on it. For me, it's that when I get out in front of those people and I see the 1,000 faces, and all of a sudden I watch lights go down on other people and you can feel the crowd, you're home. I feel like I'm home, but it's taken a while because you started off speaking in front of 50 people. Then you spoke in front of 100 people, then 500 people, then 1,000, then a couple thousand. And I think if you tried to speak in front of 2,000 people the first time, in fact, I did speak in front of 2,000 people, you're sitting backstage with that little bit of imposter syndrome speaking in your right ear going, are you worthy? And you have to be able to say, you know what? I'm ready. And it's like, I remember as a kid that I was in the theater business and you would do 3 or 4 dress rehearsals with full orchestra, full sets, full costumes, everything for 3 or 4 nights in a row before opening night. Because by that time, you were ready. You had already been on stage. You knew what the costume felt like. You knew what the lights felt like on you. You know, the only thing you were missing was the audience itself. So my question to you is, how do you simulate those positions where you can put people under pressure and give them the feeling to know, wait, am I going to break here? Am I going to break here? Or am I going to break here?
So this is where, at the elite level, visualization imagery really comes into play. Going back to the notion of our brains have a difficult time differentiating fantasy from reality, the more you can visualize and use all of your senses, you're actually tricking the brain into thinking that what's happening is real. And what they found is the same types of brain synapses that are firing when you're physically doing the movement occur when you are visualizing, as I just mentioned. You just said something very interesting because I had an opportunity to interview Julie Foudy, one of the greatest soccer players of all time. You see her on ESPN. And before World Cup match, one of her teammates went to their sports psychologist and said, I am freaking out. Like, I need you to get rid of my butterflies. which probably everybody has experienced in their lifetime. And there, Colleen Hacker, the great sports psychologist, told the team was, you don't want to get rid of your butterflies. The butterflies are your body's way of telling you that you care about what you're about to do. You need to get your butterflies to fly in formation.
I love that.
I love that kind of phraseology. But to get back to your point of that type of visualization can make you feel, if you're doing it properly, like you're really in the moment. And to me, I think it's an underutilized tool in business, particularly for individuals. And we just talked about presentations. I also think it comes into play in one-on-one interactions where sometimes leaders are terrified to give bad news to one of their employees, right? Having those tough conversations. And if you think about it, those same types of reactions in the body take place, whether you're speaking in front of 1,000 people or whether you're about to fire an individual that you really care about. You know,
sometimes it's worse one-to-one.
It is.
In fact, a lot of times it's worse one-to-one.
It can be. But the same type of body reactions take place. And that's why I think these types of tools can come into play. Another tip for your audience when it comes to self-talk, and I'm stealing a little bit now from like Carol Dweck's great work in the book Mindset, where she talks about the difference between a growth mindset versus a fixed mindset. An individual that has kind of gone up through their corporate career and has said things like, man, I've always sucked at public speaking. Well, once you have uttered that phrase in that type of manner, your brain is constantly searching then for evidence to support that belief that you suck at public speaking. And the reason why it does that is because your brain doesn't want to suffer some cognitive dissonance. It doesn't want to find evidence that it's contrary to what it's already believing. Some people think like, oh, well, then Brian's going to tell us to like, just think of rainbows and unicorns and lollipops and think the world's... No, I think the way to get around that is to say, look, I currently struggle with my public speaking and my presentation skills, but with time and effort and my work ethic, I can get better. And just that subtle change in the language from I've always sucked at to I currently struggle with might be enough for you to give yourself some grace and to put more effort into becoming a better public speaker or presenter. Because the other way around, when you just say I've always sucked at something, you're kind of in the military, we would call it like a self-licking ice cream cone. Like it's always going to be that way.
Visualization is important. I'm never going to take anything away from that. But I know in the military, you train. You know, you go live fire exercises, you go into simulations, you go in training combat. You put yourself physically in the same situation that you would be as if you were in a live situation where somebody was actually firing back at you. Are you putting your people within this four-year leadership program in physical situations where they are testing their own grit? Are you putting them in a position where they sit there and they realize, oh, okay, that was really, really hard, but I made it?
Yes. So we do this in a number of ways. And this is something that every kind of company, no matter how big you are, can do. We utilize a lot of filming students. It cracks me up that you can open up Harvard Business Review, you can open up Inc. Magazine, whatever business content you're consuming out there, and it will talk about the importance of body language and nonverbal communication. And yet, how many of us have ever seen ourselves on film? So I'll give you one thing that we do with the students. We put them in the springtime into these interdisciplinary teams of about 10 students. When I say interdisciplinary, I mean purely interdisciplinary. Two business kids, two arts and science kids, a nurse, a teacher, a diplomat, a scientist. And we put them in semester-long projects. And we use the university's Market Research Center, which is used for our marketing advertising people. But it's a conference room that is outfitted with audiovisual equipment, so you can film everything in there. There's a double pane glass on one end of the room. And on the other side of that is a control room where you can observe what's going on in the other room and see everything that's going on and hear all the audio piped in. Now, our marketing advertising people use it for focus groups, right? If you want to put a product in there and then see how it goes. But we use it as a leadership development tool. And so we will film the first ever meeting of the semester of that team where a student is in charge. There's no professors in there. It's the student running a board meeting essentially for the first time. And then we film them and we show that film to every one of those students on the team and we give them feedback as to how did they show up. And so this is a stressful situation for them, getting back to your point of like putting them in that spot where they are kind of, this is real world. This is not hypothetical scenarios. This is the real world. Let me just tell you this one quick anecdote. It also works for the student that may not be the leader to see themselves on camera. One of our students is a nursing student. She's now a senior. And when she was put through this the first time, she saw the video. And I meet with every one of those students one-on-one to talk about, to go over the film, like almost like a football coach, right? Like, what did you see in this play? What would you do different? And she came back to me and I had this whole speech prepared because she said about three words the entire 1 hour meeting. And many people can probably relate to this, especially when you're on a new team. And so I had this big, long speech about, you know, even if you're introverted, you have to find some strategic ways to engage. And so she came back in our meeting. She stopped me cold in my tracks. I said, how did you think you did? And she said, in my 4 years in high school, every teacher told me I had to be more engaged. I was too quiet. I looked like I was not participating. And she's like, I never really put any credence to that until I saw myself on film in that one room. And she said, that is not the person who I am or who I want to be. Wouldn't you know it? At the end of the semester, we have the students rank order, which is also difficult for them. Talk about putting themselves in difficult situations.
So they rank order themselves and their peers.
Yes. From 1 to 10, who's the most impactful on that team and who's the least impactful? And wouldn't you know it, that young woman, that young leader who said three words in the first session, who was not the team leader, by the way, at the end of the semester, they ranked her as the MVP, as number one.
That's awesome.
I don't credit our program with doing that. I just credit the fact that we put herself in a situation where she saw herself on film. And that, with how ubiquitous phones are and how great the cameras are, I think that is a completely underutilized tool in the corporate world in terms of leadership development of, hey, just film your people in those interactions.
You're true. We have a perception of who we are, but how we see ourselves may not be how others see us. And until we see ourselves taped and we listen to ourselves, like I listen back to my podcasts and I'll tell you something, the podcasts I did 5 years ago are awful. The questions are simplistic. The pace isn't there. There really isn't a great flow to the first episodes that I did. And it's only by being able to listen to them critically and say, oh, okay, I could have said that here. I could have done this there. We get better. And I'm sure 5 years from now, my podcast will even be better than it is today. But I think we need to be able to look at ourselves critically and say, you know what? There's room for improvement. Okay, I'm good, but I could be great. And I love the fact that you're taping these people to give them the ability to see themselves outside of their own skin.
The way I look at it is when you look at other professions and how they do things, you get better by having at-bats, like you said, but then having some type of feedback to accompany those at-bats. Going back to the basketball example, basketball players will watch with their coaches, they'll watch the film of what just happened. And so that's how they get better. And to me, our students have been able to recognize verbal tics that they have. They will be able to recognize body language, whether they're closed or open, how they react. It's been able to have us show students examples of things like mansplaining. Not just talk about it, but what does it look like in real life when that happens in a room?
And look at all the other eyes of the women rolling their eyes as soon as you said that.
Yeah. But it's those types of things that we can talk about in an abstract way. And the beautiful part of our program, Ben, is the fact that it's not for academic credit. It's all about development. And so that's, I think, what differentiates our program from other programs, which is we're not having students backfighting over getting the A in the room. It's all about getting better. And it's a really exciting program. I'm biased, but...
We could talk for another hour. I may have to have you back in order to be able to do this. I've absolutely enjoyed this. First of all, thank you for your service. What's the best way people can get in touch with you? Just so when people want to get in touch with you, then it'll all be in the show notes, but put it on air.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned, I'm probably similarly active on LinkedIn as well. So Brian Price.
Brian with a Y, yes.
Well, I would say the correct way, Ben, with a Y.
Yes, so. Exactly.
And then all of my socials are essentially Top Mental Game. So on Instagram, on Twitter, and Facebook, if you want to go take a look at Top Mental Game.
Perfect. And here's the one question I ask everybody as I close out this interview. When you get out of a meeting and you get in your car and you drive away, what's the one thing you want people to think about you when you're not in the room?
Be the leader you want to be led by.
Brian, you have been an incredible guest. Thank you for your wisdom. Thank you for that. Michael, thank you for making this introduction because it was well worth it. I appreciate it. And I hope the audience enjoyed this as much as I did.
Awesome. Thanks, Ben.
This has been the YourLivingBrand.live show. I want to thank you for tuning in today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show at YourLivingBrand.live and share your favorite episodes with colleagues and friends. At Your Brand Marketing, we help companies engage, retain, and grow their most valuable assets, their employees. If you're tired of losing great staff and want to retain your best employees, build brand champions and leaders at any level. Contact us for a 30-minute consultation at yourbrandmarketing.com. That's www.yourbrandmarketing.com. Thank you again for listening and sharing. Tune in next week when we ask another guest, what's your story?